I invite those of you who are in the way back, if you'd like to come up on the first three rows, makes it a little more cozy, and you're able to hear a little bit better in terms of what's going on. So go ahead and fill in these first three or four rows. We appreciate all of you being here tonight. It's nice to be out of the heat and into the library's well air-conditioned room. My name is Fred Oswald, and I'm the chair of the Central Region RAC, and I would like the other RAC members to introduce themselves to you and to let you know who they represent. Start with Larry.
Larry Fitzgerald, representing agricultural.
Richard Hanson, at large.
Gary Nelson, sportsman's rep.
Mike Gates with the Bureau of Land Management.
Chris Marble, public at large.
Carl Hurst, sportsman rep.
Thank you very much. We have other RAC members who are not able to be here tonight, so I'm excusing Tim Fair, Sarah Flinders, who I think is out fighting fires. Jay Price is not going to be with us. George Holmes is not able to be with us, and Dwayne. So those folks are excused. We do have a quorum, however, so we will conduct business tonight. If you haven't seen an agenda, I think there are some agendas on the table here, but I'll quickly go through and let you know what we're going to be talking about tonight. We have three action items that we're going to be talking about. The first one is the bobcat harvest recommendations. That will be an action item. Those of you who would like to talk about that, give us your input. We'd love to hear from you. Section action item is the waterfowl guidebook and rule. And again, we invite you to participate if that's something you're interested in. And finally, for the northern region and the central region, we'll be talking about the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Management Plan. This will be its first year, and so this is all new, and but because it involves lots of hunters from the central region who are involved, even though geographically it's in the northern region, I think it's appropriate that it's brought before us and that we have an opportunity to talk about it. So I'm sure all of you have had a chance to look at minutes from the last meeting. It may have been a while ago since you did look at them, but is there any additions or corrections to the minutes from last meeting? If not, I would entertain a motion to accept those minutes as presented to you by email. A motion by Gary to accept the minutes of the last meeting, seconded by Larry. Further discussion? All those in favor? And that passes unanimously. Also, I'm asking for an approval of the agenda tonight, although I do have some additions to the agenda. And with your approval, I'd like to add those. They would be listed under new business. The first one is that John Shivick is here tonight to present the bobcat harvest recommendations. But while he's here with us, I have asked him if he would give us a presentation on the cougar predator program. We had an...
Coyote.
I'm sorry. Coyote. Predator program. Where'd that come from? As you know, we took part of a extra meeting to deal with that, and I'm sure that it would be helpful to get an update from John on what's going on with the coyote predator program. So with your approval, we will add that under new business. The other thing is that we've asked, we have been asked by Dan Cockane, if he could take a few minutes and have us take a look at some ideas that he and some others have with regard to the Cougar Guidebook. Now, we are not taking up the Cougar Guidebook now. That's going to be saved for another time. But since we do have time tonight, we do have a light schedule, I suggested to John that we would give him 5 minutes to sort of let us know what he and those who have the same interests that he has give us an update on what he has in mind the next time that the Cougar guide pick is going to be presented. I understand that, Dan, you do have some friends in the audience. If you have something different than what Dan has presented, we'd love to hear from you, but if you're just here to support his recommendations, rather than take our time tonight, we would just appreciate having you let us know that you're here in support of that. So we'll see how that goes when we come to that action item. So with those two inclusions, I'll entertain a motion to accept the agenda as presented. Motion by Richard, seconded by Larry. Further discussion? All those in favor? Then we will entertain that agenda as presented, and the next item will be informational item by John Fairchild.
Regional update. It sounds like Saturday Night Live or something. At any rate, well, we've had a few fires. Fires impact wildlife, and that's like the big headline story for tonight. We thought it might have impacted how many permits we allocated by units on limited entry hunts. We looked that over and made no recommendations to change. I think everyone that had a limited entry permit in those areas that were affected by the burn had an opportunity to turn in their permit and get their bonus points restored. I don't know how that went or if there were many takers, but at any rate, we're sticking with the unit or the number of permits by unit, and most of our areas, there's sufficient areas left to be hunted, and we didn't feel like it was going to have a significant impact on the hunting. Now, on the wildlife population side, that's yet to be seen because we don't know how bad this winter is going to be. And fortunately, with the summer monsoon storms that have been coming through, we've had fairly good precip up high, and conditions are not nearly as bad as we thought they would be a month and a half ago. And so hopefully deer and elk coming off summer ranges in good condition can get through whatever winter we've got before us. But in those areas where we had significant fires, in the Wood Hollow fire especially, there's a lot of winter range that burned, and we're going to have to be looking at to determine if there's some emergency actions that we're going to have to take with regards to depredation, with regards to perhaps emergency feeding. All of those are on the table, and we'll be watching that very closely. The other is, with the poor precip that we had, the lack of snowpack, our reservoirs were high going in. They're certainly dropping pretty quickly. Our stream flows are probably the biggest concern right now. We're having isolated fish kills on some streams that just don't have enough water to meet the needs of irrigation and maintain fish. And those are, it's unfortunate, but that's just what we have to deal with in low water years. People have a right to irrigate their crops, and water law is pretty clear on the use of water in the state. And unless there's, in stream flows that are purchased, you may drop below the level that'll support fish in sections. It's usually not entire stretches, but there are sections. So those are the two biggies. I'll quickly go through by section. In our wildlife section, we are conducting elk and pronghorn classification right now, and I did send out an announcement to all the RAC members that if you're interested in getting with one of our biologists and participate in that, please contact Craig. Perhaps Tom Becker is going to a better Craig's ill right now, so Tom might be a good contact. Is that true, Tom? There you go. he can direct you to the right biologist based on where you want to go. We will be having the coyote check-in program beginning the 1st of September, and John Shivick's here to give us some details on that. Aerial survey of Rocky Mountain goats will take place this week. And we are still receiving wolf sighting reports in Diamond Fork Canyon. The latest one in Fifth Water, just August 1st. Seemed fairly credible, but we still don't have evidence. A lot of anecdotal and a lot of good. You know, we think that there are wolf-like or wolves up there. We just don't know if they're hybrids or not. Quite frankly, we know they're not coyotes. We know that much. In our habitat section, you can imagine with all these burns, a lot of our projects kind of got bumped. And I'm not sure how many of them. We had plans of doing a lop and scatter on the Manti Face, bull hog treatment on Dairy Fork, 12 Mile. We were going to do some shrub plantings. North Hollow down by Mayfield, we had some lop and scatter there. Maple Canyon, a bull hog treatment, that's west of Manti. But the Wood Hollow, Ophir Canyon, dump fire there at Saratoga Springs, and the Dallas Canyon on the Cedar Mountains may redirect resources, redirect the seed that we have in order to do those projects and assist other federal, you know, land management agencies, BLM included, in seeding those. And that's a huge effort that's undergoing right now with a lot of state and federal agencies trying to scramble, because you have just a small window to get that seed in the ground in the fall following the burn to be most successful. So we're working on that really, really intently. Aquatics, again, I mentioned low flows. We had a significant loss of brown trout on the Sandpitch River. Most of the brown trout were lost, and native species, speckled dace and leatherside chub numbers were probably reduced to 10% of their normal populations. Just for those that are interested, we're planning to stick with our bass regulations at Utah Lake at 6 and only 1 over 12. That was quite a discussion that we had earlier this year at our open house that we held with the anglers, and we'll just stick with what we had. In outreach, we've done a huge effort, and Scott Root is to be credited for the work that's going on at with the Boy Scout camps, trying to get them aware of what they need to do to avoid problems with bears. And our COs, Preston Mickelson down in San Pete County, has been hitting the Typhi campground east of Mount Pleasant every Monday night, trying to get the word out. It's amazing how much candy and cookies show up after his visit when he gives them a little scare, you know, that your tent could be visited if you have these things. So we had a bat event at Hogle Zoo that was very successful. About 80 people showed up to learn about bats from Kimberly Hersey. And we're also in promoting this new predator control program. So there's a lot going on in outreach. In law enforcement, Jody Becker's here if any of you are interested in more details. But our lieutenant, quite a successful operation with Juab County Sheriff and DEA to shut down a marijuana grove in east of Levan there in Juab County. 5,100 plants seized. Did arrest one individual. But these marijuana grows present a significant environmental impact. There's a fair amount of poaching that probably goes on. There's baiting of rodents with rodenticides that then enter the food chain. There's an incredible amount of water that's diverted away from where its beneficial use, where the water rights are held. It's just something that Wildlife Resources is also very concerned about, and we have a group, a couple teams that are very active with other law enforcement agencies in the state in in trying to shut down these grows. So that's about it. And I probably took too much time, but it's all yours.
Thank you, John. Any questions for John from RAC members or the audience? We'll move on then. I failed to recognize the most important person here tonight, and that's Mr. John Baer sitting in the back of the room. John is a member of the Wildlife Board. He is generous enough with his time to always be with us at the RAC meeting. And on behalf of the RAC, I'd like to welcome you here tonight, John, and tell you how much we appreciate you being here. As we go through the next item, if you have any additions and corrections, John, as I go through the Wildlife Board meeting update from June, I would appreciate if you would correct me or add to. Gentlemen and ladies, at the last Wildlife Board meeting, there were a number of different motions, and I'll just go through those motions briefly, let you know whether they passed or not. And if you have questions, you can ask me or John. First of all, there was a motion to move that the division publish an annual report on the money spent for conservation projects. I know that came up in our meeting. We were spoke positively about that, and that move was passed unanimously. So there will be an annual report published on how the money is spent that comes from those conservation projects and permits. Second of all, there was a motion that all species be included in the option mechanisms for reducing the number of conservation permits if the number of public permits declines during the time period for which multi-year permits were awarded. I know that's a mouthful, but that motion passed unanimously. Then there was a motion to adopt the division's recommendations and table for sheep, and that motion passed unanimously. Then there was a motion to accept the division's method for calculating conservation permit numbers for all other species as presented, and that motion passed 5-1. Next, there was a motion that we accept the remainder of the division's proposals as presented for the conservation permit rule and amendment, and that passed unanimously, and I believe it was our RAC's position that we passed that unanimously as well. Next, there was a motion to approve the division's recommendations on collection, importation, and possession, Rule 657-03. We also sent that on with a unanimous recommendation, and that passed unanimously by the board. Next, there was a motion to approve the division variance rule amendments with the exception that we move once in a lifetime to be allowed to have a seasoned extension or the option to retain their bonus points and waive their waiting period for once in a lifetime. I believe we did act on that and set it on unanimously. That was passed unanimously with the exception of the once in a lifetime that be allowed to have an season extension. Then the board dealt with the deer management plan. There was a motion to accept the division's deer management plan as presented. That motion passed unanimously as it did with our RAC. There was a motion to accept the division's, there was a motion that we keep the, with regard to elk, there was a motion that we keep the current permit numbers on all elk management plans. Our RAC moved to accept the division's recommendations as presented. When the motion to keep the current numbers as from last year's numbers, that motion failed 4-2. So then there was a motion to approve the, accept the division's recommendations as presented with regard to the elk management plan, and that did pass. And that was all of the action items that were presented at the board that had to do with our region. Any questions for me or for John Baer on what happened at the board meeting. Okay, then we'll move on to our first action item. In doing that, for those of you who are here tonight to let us know how you feel about these action items, let me just briefly go through our meeting framework. For our three action items tonight, we're going to be asking one of the division staff to make a brief presentation offering some background information on why the division is making their proposal. At the end of the presentation, I'll ask the RAC members if they have any questions or clarification, and then I'll ask you as audience members if you have any questions or clarification on the proposal. Once those questions have been answered, we'll move on to comment period. And if you're here to make a comment, I would ask you to fill out one of our yellow comment cards before you make your comment and let me have those. If you're here representing yourself, I'd like you to try and take no more than 3 minutes in letting us know how you feel on the proposal. If you're here representing a group, let us know which group you're here representing, and we're going to let you have 5 minutes to let us know how your group feels about the presentation. Once we've received all those comments from you folks, we'll turn it back to the RAC for their discussion and disposal. So with that in mind, if you do want to make a comment, fill out one of these yellow comment cards. I think there's some back at this blue table that you can fill out your name and which proposal you want to comment on. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and begin. Our first action item is Bobcat Harvest Recommendations, and that will be presented by John Civic, the Mammals Coordinator for the division. John?
Thank you. So this plan is, like I said, it's on a one-year rotation, so you'll see me back every year compared to some of the other plans that have gone to a three-year cycle, like Bear and Cougar. The plan's also fairly simple in the terms of there's four different metrics that we look at, and we use those metrics to identify if we want to go back to our baseline for permits or adjust the permits, and I'll explain based on this year's data, and I'll go into this here a little bit more. It's actually pretty simple, okay? The performance targets are these based on these four variables, and that's the proportion of kittens and yearlings that are taken, you know, that are presented in the, that are harvested. Then we can calculate the adult survival rate. It's an estimate we can make mathematically. Then the proportion of females that are taken relative to the total animals that are taken. And then the set days per bobcat, which is an estimate of the that we do through surveys in order to get an estimate of effort, essentially. The target ranges were produced by looking back at the data we've collected on these variables since the 80s. So we've got quite a few years, 30, 40 years of data. We look at what's normal based on those data, and then we come up with this target range. Basically, there's the mean, and then there's the variance around that mean that we use to produce the target range. So we have these performance targets, and we try to hit one of each of those every year. The 2012 data, the proportion of kittens and yearlings that we observed was 0.35. The adult survival was 0.7. That means out of every 100 cats that year, 70 are likely to survive. It's a pretty good survival rate. The proportion of females in the harvest was 0.45, and the set days per bobcat was 400. So to outline it as relative to our targets, the proportion of kittens and yearlings was a little low. The adult survival and females were right in there where they're supposed to be, and the set days per bobcat was quite a bit high. There's a lot more effort for people to spend to get those animals. So the plan states, it's pretty simple, if any two performance targets are outside of the range, we'd adjust the number of tags per individual by 1 to 2. However, we can keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year if variables are moving towards target ranges. So to see if we're moving towards the target ranges, then we just look at 2011 as well. So if I put the 2011-2012 data up there next to each other, you can see that kittens and yearlings in 2011 was lower. It's moved higher in 2012, so we're moving in the right direction. Survival and percent female is still in range both of those years, and the set days per bobcat was 490, now it's down to 400, so that's moving in the right range. So based on the requirements of the plan, we have two that are in, two that are out, but those two that are out are moving in the right direction. So that gives us a real simple recommendation for this year, which is consistency with the previous year. That is, if you were to pull out the guidebook for this year and look at a recommended guidebook for next year, they'd look essentially the same. The permits, maximum number of permits, 4,600. Limit of 3 permits per individual, exactly like it was last year. The seasons, November 28th to February 3rd, those have been adjusted for the days of the week, so they start and end on the same days of the week, and we don't start a season on a Sunday. But other than that, they're essentially the same as last year. So very simple recommendations, and I can be happy to take questions.
Questions for John from RAC members? John, would you mind putting the slide back up that shows the targets?
Is that one good enough?
Yeah.
So you can see where we're.
My question has to do with the 197. What does the 197 have to do with?
The 197 is set days per bobcat, and we get the set days per bobcat by surveying trappers, call them, ask them how many days they put their traps out, how many traps they put out, and then you can calculate the number of trap days per trapper. So for instance, if we just called one person and he had 100 traps that he set one night, that'd be 100 trap nights, or 100 set days. And if he caught 5 bobcats, that'd be 5 bobcats per set day.
And is the 197 a performance target?
It is. It's in the plan. These are the 4 variables that we're going for. And it's actually a target, yes, exactly.
So I guess my question is, if that's one of the 4 variables and it's so out of line, even though it's moving towards target, it went from 495 to 400, but it's still a huge amount away.
Right.
Why wouldn't that be of concern? Because it's such a, it's twice as much as right. What the target ought to be.
I think that's an excellent question, and I've looked at the set days per bobcat quite a bit. That metric, that measure is probably one of the, less precise, loosest, I'm not sure exactly, most difficult to interpret, maybe. It's good information because it gives us an idea of how many people are afield and how much effort they're putting into it. But it's heavily influenced by such things as pelt price and then how many newer people are in trapping. So there tends to be a core group of trappers that know what they're doing or that are very familiar with the area, very familiar with the cats, very familiar with trapping methods, and they'll always consistently pull in the same, more or less the same number of animals. If I go and I played around with the data a little bit, and the one thing that really influences the most what happens with set days, the total number of set days, is what the previous year's pelt price is. So if we had a large or high pelt price last year, then we have a bunch of people trying it out this year, and then newer people aren't as efficient. And so it's not that the bobcats are down necessarily, it's that we have a lot of people that aren't as good at trappers. And so that that effect happens to, that can really mess up that set days per bobcat calculation. So for that reason, it's not the only thing we look at. We look at those other variables a lot more.
Thank you. Questions for John from the audience on his presentation? Oh, go ahead, Gary.
Hey, a few years ago when we adjusted the cat tag numbers down, I think it was Kevin was the guy that was doing it then, and he said they had trapped too many adult, or in too many males, large adults.
Right.
Uh-huh. And he says that was one of the triggers, and we had exceeded the trigger, and so the number of tags had to go down, and we reduced the number of tags at that time by two, and we've since got one back. Are the cats still down, or are the population still under? Or are we ready to go back to what it used to be?
Well, the way they put the plan now, it's kind of difficult to figure out numbers exactly. My guess is cats are doing pretty well. Lagomorphs and things, rabbits and those animals, they are coming back. We don't have a good precise number on what the bobcats are doing. But based on, we kept our management the same, they're getting better. It leads us to believe that, the populations are probably improving for these guys, if that makes sense.
Because I know that one year it was kind of a skewed data item. Cats were worth a lot of money that year, and so Exactly. Everybody was letting go their little cats and their mediums, and there was enough cats around, they were just waiting until they got the big ones to bring them in.
Right.
But, it's been different ever since then.
Yeah. So.
Other questions? Questions from the audience? If you wouldn't mind coming up to this microphone up in front and let us know who you are and ask your question.
I got a question with the bobcats and your set days. I mean, last year's winter was very mild, so it was a premium for trappers. They didn't have the days where the traps were freezing off. These every day was used. A lot more days were used, so I think that your number on 400 days doesn't quite benefit it the way it should. I think it's showing. I think it would have been more towards your 492, but you got a lot more days where the traps were still functioning. Just a lack of snow. We had very little snow. And then also when the kittens and yearlings, for that to be down, that would be a serious red flag. From what I've seen, the bobcat populations, they wouldn't say they're growing at all. And having years off of them last year, that per day should win.
That would be the question you could ask John.
The cat that we got, pretty big one.
But I think it's something to take into consideration with those numbers. There was a heck of a lot more days those traps were working than the winter before. Winter before, we had a lot of days that those traps were shut down. So, just a question for you.
Thank you. John, do you want to respond?
As best I can. No, those are excellent points. A couple things. One, again, we're in the bounds of... These aren't arbitrary things that I came up with last year or anything. These are... according to the plan, the plan's put together, it's vested through all the racks, it's put through the board, and then once this goes to the board, then it becomes, this is what we do, this is how we manage the populations. So it's gone through that long process, and this is what we have, and this is what I have to follow in terms of managing this species. And some of the other comments had to do with any given year, and this is why I've seen some benefit and some of the other animals moving to three-year plans, because any one year, you have a late snow, you have an early snow, fell prices, whatever, it can really skew that one-year data point. So it does help to have a few years in a row. And there's been something nice about this one. They amended the plan last year to add that look at the year before to see if you're going in the right direction. So that's kind of a new thing in the plan to help give us a little leeway. And so we are incorporating better multiple years and having better information, but the process isn't perfect, but it's based on good science though.
Thank you. Other questions from the audience? Come on up.
Jet Young, I'm just representing myself. Last year, the way the management plan was set up, my question, the tag numbers had to fluctuate by like two or three, and last year this was changed to where they can fluctuate one tag number a year. Is that correct?
Well, the big change last year was just this language, this keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year, because I can clarify this a little bit. I didn't put this all in the presentation. But essentially, the first strategy would be to maintain the baseline management strategy if two variables are outside of the historic range, or return to baseline if less variables are outside of the historic range for two consecutive years. And the baseline strategy is six tags per individual, a season length from third Wednesday in November to second Sunday in February, and no cap on the number of tags sold. So it'd be unlimited number of tags, and then six tags per individual. And then we got here by adjusting it through time is where we're at this, our current three and, 4,600. So that's what we're working off of now, and that's what we adjust with. And I hope that clarified a little bit.
It does. I just remembered going through it, and before it was huge, drastic changes, and now it's smaller with actually a cap on it. I guess kind of declare that up. There's a cap on it now that wasn't in place. Everybody could buy three tags. So there actually is a reduction.
Right. No, that's a good point. It's hasn't gone back to... That put the brakes on that second line that they added last year, which helps us out a lot.
Yeah, that helps to know a little bit of the history. Other questions for John on this item? Yeah. Come on up. You can fill that out later. You're going to do a comment on this one?
Yeah.
Or just a question?
A question.
Go ahead. You don't need to fill out one for a question.
I thought I needed that. Okay.
You've got to start attending more of these meetings, young man.
Well, I missed one last year. I just had a question for my own curiosity. Are we managing bobcats because of the demand for pelts, or are we managing them because they consider them a predator and because they're an influence on as a predator? The reason I ask that is because a few years ago I read a study about a fellow who had done some research on antelope fawn mortality down around Delta, and it was a two-year study, and the conclusions were that bobcats were a major influence on fawn mortality, and so that's why I asked that question.
Yeah. The simplest way, I guess, to answer that question, just to read the goal statement for the plan. And the goal statement for the plan is to maintain a healthy bobcat population within existing suitable habitat and provide quality recreational opportunities for bobcat harvest while considering the social aspects of bobcat harvest. So it's trying to do everything as usual.
Thank you, and thanks for that question. Other questions? If not, we'll go ahead and close the question period. I do not have any comment cards from audience members who'd like to make a comment on this presentation. Anybody in the audience would like to make a comment on the bobcat harvest recommendations? Come on back up.
Chet Young, representing myself. I just wanted to say I support the division's proposal.
Thank you. Having no other comments, we'll go ahead and close the comment period and bring it back to RAC members for your discussion and disposal. Chris.
Unless anybody's got a comment, I'll make a motion to accept the division's recommendation as proposed.
Motion before the RAC to accept the division's recommendations. That is seconded by Gary. Further discussion? All those in favor? Opposed? And that passes unanimously. We'll go to our next action item. And we're changing gears a little bit here. We welcome Blair Stringham, who's going to be presenting the waterfowl guidebook and rule for this year. So, Blair, welcome to the RAC, and take it away.
Okay. Tonight I will be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2012 and 2013 waterfowl hunt season. So each year we look at two important surveys to actually formulate our hunt recommendations. The first one of those being a habitat survey, and that's the number of ponds in May, and they're counted each year to give us an idea of how much habitat's out there for breeding waterfowl populations. The second important survey that we look at is a waterfowl pair count, so essentially a count of the number of pairs of waterfowl out there to give us an idea of where our populations are going to be for that upcoming year. And first I wanted to summarize this data for you guys. As far as our May pond counts went, compared to last year, it was a relatively dry year. Throughout the prairies of Canada and the United States, water numbers were down, and so we saw fewer ponds in those areas. Compared to our long-term average, it's nothing to really be too concerned about. We're still hanging about right there around our long-term average. So overall, just a drier year compared to last. The number of populations numbers that we're seeing, we'll start out first with the geese. In Utah, we saw an increase in geese as from last year compared to this year. Overall, the long-term numbers of geese in Utah are down a little bit, but nothing really to be too concerned about. And flyway-wide, geese are still looking really good. Our tundra swan populations, we do two surveys each year. One of those is a midwinter survey. Compared to last year, numbers were up, and compared to the long-term average, swan numbers are up across the flyway. There's another survey that's also done in Alaska. I'm just looking at the number of swans, and those are up as well. So swans are doing great in the Pacific flyway. This is the duck data that was collected this year. I just wanted to highlight a few of these waterfowl species. Mallards are probably the most important species in our flyway. They're used as an index for the rest of the waterfowl populations. From the mallard populations, we can get a rough estimate of what other species are doing, and we use the mallard populations to formulate our overall harvest package each year. Three or four of the species of concern I wanted to touch on real quick. Pintail numbers. Pintails are down from last year and down from their long-term average. We have had some concerns of pintail numbers in the past. It can be somewhat misleading this year because as we have drier conditions in the prairies, pintails will actually go farther north to nest, and we aren't able to detect them as easily. And so the pintail numbers, they're still down overall, and so it does result in a reduction of our bag for pintails. Camelback numbers are doing really well. They're above their long-term average and continue to increase, and so it may be in the near future we could increase our camelback harvest. Scalp numbers are one of the success stories over the last several years. They have been down, but they continue to increase the last several years. And as a result, this year we are able to offer a larger bag for scalp, which I'll discuss in a minute. Redhead numbers throughout the flyway, about similar to last year, and overall they are above their long-term average. Like I was saying earlier, based upon our mallard populations is how we get our season framework. And this year, because we did have high mallard populations, it's recommended that we have a liberal hunting package. The liberal hunting package allows us to have the maximum number of days and the largest bag offered to us by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so for this year, we'll select the liberal baggage as our package as our recommendation, which will give us a 107-day season and a bag of 7 birds. There are several species, though, that do have a reduced bag. First one is pintails. It'll be a 107-day season with a bag of 2. Camelback will have a 7-day season with a bag of 1. And scalp populations, which is a change from last year, will be up to a 107-day season and a bag of 7. So the season dates that we're recommending for this year, the duck, merganser, and coot season will begin on October 6th and run to the 19th of January. The bag will be 7 birds per day with a possession limit of 14, and that can't include any more than 2 hen mallards, 2 pintails, 2 redheads, and 1 canvasback per day. And the coot season will be the same as the duck season with a bag limit of 25 per day. A dart goose season. In the northern zone, it'll run from October 6th to January 19th. Outside of that zone, the season will start on October 6th and go till the 18th of October. Then be a period where it's closed and resume again on the 27th of October and run until January 27th. A bag for dart geese will be 3 per day and 6 in possession. The light goose season in the northern zone begins on October 27th and runs till January 19th. It's closed for a period and then resumes on the 18th of February and runs till March 10th. Outside of that zone, the opener will be on October 16th and run until January 19th. Pause for a bit and then resume again on the March 1st through the 10th. The light goose bag is 10 per day and 20 in possession. Our snipe season will be October 6th through January 19th. We can harvest 8 per day and have 16 in possession. Our swan season dates will be October 6th through December 9th, and this is only within the Great Salt Lake hunting area. And the permit numbers will be the same as last year, 2,000 permits. Our falconry season will be October 6th through January 19th. It allows for 3 birds daily and 6 in possession. And our youth waterfowl day will be on September 22nd this year, which is 2 weeks prior to the opening of the duck hunt. For shooting hours, we do have several counties with shooting restrictions. This is largely because of the large number of hunters that are in the around duck habitat hunting on opening day. So we like it to be a little bit lighter during our opening day hunt. And that's in Box Elder, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, and Cache counties. The rest of the state opening day, shooting will begin on half hour before sunrise. And for the rest of the season, shooting hours will be a half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset. There are several WMAs around the Great Salt Lake that could potentially be closed, and this would be due to us treating Phragmites, which is an invasive plant species. What we do during that period is we try to burn off all the residual vegetation. It opens up the area and allows for new shoots of other species to grow up and allows us to treat those areas a little bit easier the following season because we don't have to work with all that dead vegetation that's above the growing material. There's one specific recommendation for the northern region. We had some conflicts between user groups on the Antelope Island Causeway. And with that recommendation, we are recommending a 600-foot buffer on both sides of the road, which would begin on the Feebu side of the island and run all the way to the island. It will continue to allow people to hunt that area just outside of that 600-foot buffer. I'll take questions if you may have any.
Thank you, Blair. Questions from the RAC? Chris.
Thank you. What kind of conflicts did you have out there for the recommendation for the 600-foot buffer?
On the causeway, we had several really high-profile waterfowl species out there last year. If any of you are familiar with it, we don't get many sea ducks around here, but occasionally we get scoter and long-tailed ducks and several ducks like that. Last year we had a pair of harlequins which were spotted out there, and so they became a really high-profile species for birders that wanted to visit the area and look at those birds. Unfortunately, they're also a trophy species in Utah because we don't get many of them, so we were brought aware of the situation because hunter and the birding group conflicts. And so we had one of our personnel in the northern region, Randy Berger, who met with all the interest groups, the birding community, the hunters, as well as the state parks personnel. And based upon his meetings with them, they all came to the consensus that a buffer along that causeway would probably be the safest just to avoid any safety issues. And because, I mean, it's really a narrow strip of land and people are hunting directly from that. So,
do you know what sportsmen's organizations were represented in that discussion?
I don't remember specifically. I think the Utah Waterfowl Association was one of them. And can tell you the other ones offhand. But.
It's always been interesting that it seemed to me if you had good conditions for ducks, all the ducks would go up. Can you talk about maybe pintails which are going down and scop that are, or pintails that are going down, scop that are going up? Why one's up, one's down?
Okay. A lot of it just depends on the areas that these birds are nesting in. If we have a lot of water in the Prairie Pothole region in particular, that's a really high priority area for pintails, and so when water numbers are down, usually pintail numbers are down. You know, it's like that with all waterfowl species. Pintails have kind of become a concern because a lot of their habitat is diminished, particularly in California, where we have really, really large populations of pintails in the Pacific Flyway. And a lot of that agriculture that we had many years ago has been converted into urban areas and things like that, and so. What's resulted is their populations just being down. They have been on the increase, though, overall, and so we're hoping that if we continue to have some wet years, those populations will build. Scop populations, they tend to nest farther north up in the boreal forest regions of Canada and Alaska, and so those species have just done quite well with the reduced bag limits as well as just overall conditions have improved, and so those populations have improved as well.
Other questions? Questions from the audience for on the presentation? Seeing that, I'll go ahead and close the question period and open up for comments. I don't have any comment cards on the presentation. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to talk about the waterfowl guidebook and rule? If not, we'll go ahead and close the comment period and open it up to the RAC for your discussion and disposal.
We'll go ahead and make a motion, Fred, to accept the division's proposal.
Okay, there's a motion before us to accept the division's proposal as presented on the waterfowl guidebook and rule. Is there a second? Second by Richard. Further discussion? All those in favor? Opposed? And that passes unanimously. And Blair, will ask you to stay with us and make your presentation again on the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Plan. Again, as I mentioned in the introduction, the Great Salt Lake geographically is in the northern region, but since we have a number of hunters from our own central region that go up there and hunt, we thought it was a good idea to make the presentation to us tonight, and that's why this is a brand new management plan, and this will be its first year. So with that introduction, Blair, we'll invite you to go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll be presenting the Utah Waterfowl Hunting Plan for the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Areas. And the reason for this plan is because there's been a need to address some of the issues that have occurred between the hunting public and the Great Salt Lake ecosystem. And so in order to accomplish this, we formulated a committee last summer that was composed of sportsmen and conservation organizations, airboat, mud motor, motorless users, guides and outfitters, and Division of Wildlife Waterfowl Management Area managers. And we wanted to solicit input from this group of individuals to try to get an idea of some of their concerns for the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, as well as their concerns for hunting that occurs in those areas. And so from that, we were able to take their ideas and formulate a management plan to help us guide our management actions on our waterfowl management areas along the Great Salt Lake. And so briefly, I just wanted to touch on some of the goals that we had in this plan and highlight a few of the strategies that we're going to use to move towards those and tell you about the objectives. So the first goal was an outreach and education goal. And the objective is to increase waterfowl awareness and understanding through 2017. And so some of the strategies we'll use to address this objective is to survey hunters about their level of understanding about waterfowl issues occurring on the Great Salt Lake. So we want to get an idea of what people's education are surrounding these issues. We want to also provide them with literature on waterfowl identification, waterfowl management area maps, our management activities, and other information to help them to understand how we're managing waterfowl in the area and become more aware of the issues surrounding the Great Salt Lake. The second goal we have is a hunter retention and recruitment goal. We want to try to increase waterfowl hunters statewide by 6,500 throughout 2017. And to accomplish this, we'd like to try as much as possible to support the hunting workshops and events that are put on by youth by some of the conservation organizations. Also support any of the DWR law enforcement youth hunt mentoring program. This is an important one internally that we do to try to recruit youth to waterfowl hunting. And also just overall try to promote waterfowl hunting opportunities using our various media outlets. Third goal is an operation and maintenance goal, and our objective is to fund or maintain adequate funding for wetland management and expand management activities through 2017. And one thing that we rely on heavily is our volunteers who come out and help us on the waterfowl management areas. So we want to continue to increase our opportunities for those guys to come out and help us because they are a valuable resource for us. We want to continue to find ways to partner with sportsmen's groups on various projects around the Great Salt Lake, and also generate a list of projects where special funding can be used. Occasionally we do have funding that comes available, and we want to have high priority projects that we can immediately direct those funds into to increase our habitat along the Great Salt Lake. Our fourth goal is habitat management, and the objective is to improve habitat quality and quantity through 2017. One of the biggest challenges we face along the Great Salt Lake is the invasive plant species, Phragmites. And so we want to continue to aggressively treat that species, try to eradicate it, at least from within our WMAs, as much as possible to provide more waterfowl habitat and hunting opportunities. We also want to manage our water levels. Our water levels can fluctuate widely throughout the state. In our waterfowl management areas, we also actually have the ability to stabilize those water levels. And depending on the depth of the water, you can maximize or severely impact your habitat. And so we want to try to maximize those water levels as much as possible to benefit the waterfowl. I want to develop water management plans for all of our WMAs, as well as mitigate any impacts to the wetlands as much as possible occurring around the Great Salt Lake. Last goal is a hunt management goal. And the objective is to maintain high quality hunting opportunities through 2017. And we want to try to expand hunter access to the WMAs and Great Salt Lake. Many of these areas where Phragmites is growing, it creates just a dense jungle of growth. And so it's hard for people to access some of these areas. And so look at ways of expanding access that way, or albeit through land or whatever may be necessary. I'd also like to establish some rest areas on some of the units or WMAs where it may be appropriate. Provide opportunities for hunters with disabilities, as well as monitoring our hunter satisfaction and crowding surveys. Occasionally, we do these every couple years just to try to get a feel for overall hunter satisfaction along the Great Salt Lake or crowding issues. If these do become an issue, then we do have several things in place that we will survey people again, provide a follow-up survey to see what ideas they may have as far as addressing these issues or ideas that we may have and see how supportive they are of those. Several site-specific recommendations also came from this committee, and that was to establish more small impoundments on our WMAs, try to acquire new lands when possible, repair some of our older dike systems to maintain adequate water levels, and establish rest areas in some of these areas. So that concludes or sums up the plan, and I'll take any questions you guys may have.
Question for Blair from Raptor.
Blair, looking through the plan, perfect examples. Habitat management, strategy number one, aggressively manage the spread of Phragmites through herbicide applications and so on. I notice that there's no specific goals, whether it be number of acres or some number set to that. It seems like some of the plan is lacking a little bit of teeth in that way. Do you know why there's not some specific goals in the plan?
We tried to put as many as we possibly knew we had control over. Some of those, like for instance with the Phragmites program, there's some years where, you know, we can go out and we can spray quite a bit, but it does require follow-up burns. And so some years we're not actually able to burn because of weather conditions or getting permits and such. And so we left that out just because it may be something that would be unattainable. There is some variability there that we don't have much control over. If any other specific examples, but for the most part we tried to put in measurable goals and put in, you know, a time period that we could try to accomplish that or a number.
Do you have, what I'm getting at with this is, do you know how much treatment needs to be done to make an impact, or is that something that is not known at this point?
It's something that we haven't done really too many studies on. If left in shallow water conditions, you could have a spot as big as this room that could be water one year and Phragmites the next. And so what we found is, you know, the less you have, the better. And so the more areas that we can try to eradicate it or open up will provide opportunities for waterfowl to utilize. And so our goal is just to try to treat as much as we possibly can each year.
Other questions? I have one question. I'm just wondering, a large part of that area is private clubs, and is there a reason that there wasn't any mention of possible partnerships or coordination with the private clubs in the area with regard to the goals and objectives of the plan?
Yeah. So as far as the plan is concerned, we tried to focus specifically on just our WMAs around the Great Salt Lake. Aside from the plan, we do talk quite frequently with the club managers, and they actually have a little more leeway as far as the things we can do. And so we have worked with them, trying to train them on how we've been doing Phragmites removals. And we do have quite a bit of close contact with them. But the reason why we didn't leave them out of the plan was because we tried to focus primarily on the areas we have ultimate control over, which are waterfowl management areas.
Thank you. Questions from the audience for Blair? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the question period. I have no comment cards on this proposal, so if we have no one from the audience who wants to comment on the Great Salt Lake plan, we'll go ahead and bring it back to the rack for your discussion. How about a motion? Gary. Okay. There's been a motion to accept the division's proposal on the Great Salt Lake Management Plan. Second by Chris. Further discussion? Those in favor? And that passes unanimously. I would just suggest, Blair, that it might just be something you might want to reconsider in terms of just mentioning the private clubs in the plan, just for two reasons. One, to show that there's a shared responsibility for the ecosystem up there on both the public-private partnership, and two, if they're mentioned, they might feel like they, you know, really are full partners in dealing with all of the, you know, problems and goals that are going on. So I would make that recommendation. Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it. We then move on to our last two items, and these are non-action items. Just by way of show of hands, how many of you folks are here tonight to talk about cougars? Thank you. Let me suggest that there may have been some miscommunication or misunderstanding on behalf of this being an action item tonight. Let me see if I can explain that. The Cougar Plan, I think, as you guys know, and men and women know better than I do, is on a three-year plan. And the three-year plan is actually up next year. And as it is up next year, what typically happens with any plan that needs to be renewed, the plan is sent out to all of the RACs for the review. The division makes recommendations for any changes or revision to the plans. The RAC listens to that proposal and recommendations, and then we make our own recommendations to the board. And then the board goes ahead and deals with that plan, and they're the ones that make the final approval. It just so happens that because it's a three-year plan, the first time that the Wildlife Board will be considering this plan will be exactly 1 year from now at their August meeting. So the first time that we will be considering it as an action item will actually be 1 year from now in our August meeting, and then we'll be making recommendations. So with that understanding, I want you to know that I appreciate you being here tonight, and since you are here tonight, I want to hear, and I think the RAC members want to hear what you have to say. But as you stand before us, I do have five comment cards of people and six comment cards of people who'd like to talk about their love of cougars and cougar hunting and what they think about the current management plan. I'd like all of you to keep in mind as you come to the microphone that we will not be making a recommendation to the board tonight. We will not be taking any action because the board has not asked us to consider it and will not ask us to consider it for a year. So we would love to have you be back here in a year and let us know what you think about the plan and how you think it ought to be changed or revised or kept in place. So with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and let you folks comment tonight because we do want to hear from you, but I want everybody to kind of understand where we are. We're basically a year away from really taking any action on how you feel and your consideration, your proposals and your recommendations. So with that said, RAC members and audience, Jason, you're up and you've got 3 minutes to tell us what you think.
Don't I get five? We're at San Pete County, Townsman. I'll take whatever you give me.
Go ahead.
Anyways, what I've got here in San Pete County, on the Southwest Manti, our cats are in major trouble due to this plan that they came up with. They lumped all of these cheap units into one harvest objective unit. We're not a sheep unit. You know what? The sheep units here, they used to kill 40 cats in a three-month season here off a tent. Now we kill two in a year-round season. Two on one unit, six on the other unit, year-round season. West Nebo, same thing. They can't fill the quota. Those cats are gone. So now they put the quota on us, on the Manti unit. The Manti unit was overkilled this year by 10 cats over the quota. The quota was 8 cats. They killed 18 this year. 2 years ago, they went 6 over the quota. Same unit. The Southwest Manti unit has been wiped out. And to put these units all together is ridiculous. Even the Monroe unit. The Monroe unit, Clint Meekum, has collared cats down there. Clint came to one of our meetings, explained to us, this is halfway into the split unit season. He had 20 collared cats. Out of those 20, 8 of them had been killed. I don't know about you, but as a deer population, if they killed dang near half your deer halfway through the season, I think you'd be upset. And these cats are in trouble. I enjoy them. I really, all of us do. And I want to be able to take my kids and show them a cat. I don't want to be the reason, because somebody doesn't understand these units, that we have no cats in them. And I'm telling you what, there's very few left down there. It's not uncommon to travel 70 miles to find one lion to chase. 70 miles on a snowmobile, that's a lot. And that's with good houndsmen. That's with houndsmen that know what they're doing. And a lot of guys want to tell you there's cats behind every tree. I'd be willing to bet they can't tell you the difference between a cat and a coyote. Our cat populations are in trouble. I'm asking for your help. This needs to be shut down. The units need to be divided. We need to go back to a limited entry unit on that Manti. It has been slaughtered. And I think you know, these mountains here, they're rugged, they're tough. They're not an easy place to hunt. They're a nightmare to turn a pack of hounds loose on compared to the Manti. And these quotas come into the same place. I mean, we've got 24 on the Nebo West face. We only fill 11 of them. Everything that's left over comes down to the Manti. You've got 12 on the Wasatch Mountains tent. Two of them are filled. Two of them out of 12. We used to kill 40 there in a month, and the season shut down. Those cats are gone. You got on the Wasatch Mountains Cascade, the quota's at 12, they killed 6. That's a year-round season. We're giving guys all year now. Those quotas are coming to the Manti, and I need that stopped. We all do. We want to have some cats to hunt somewhere. And I'm a deer hunter. I love to hunt deer. But I can guarantee you one thing, the cats are not your problem. They're not. The cat populations are the lowest I've seen them in 30 years. And I can understand wanting to bring the deer herds back. I want to bring them back as bad as anybody. But this, you know, when it's going that deep, 8 cats in a month of the split unit of the collared cats, 8 out of 20 are dead, that's pretty deep. And then 16 cats in 3 years. The quota on the Manti was 8 cats this year and last year and 5 the year before. The year they were 5, they killed 11. Last year they killed 8. That was on they were able to control it, and we didn't have to bring the quotas from off these temp units and the Nebo. The sheep units weren't part of us. So it stopped where it should have. It was limited. This year, the quota was at 8. They killed 18. That's too many. And on these numbers, there's 9 cats that aren't accounted for. There was 94 cats killed total. The numbers I got from John only show 85. So there's 9 cats missing. I don't know if those other 9 came off the Manti. I don't know where they came. But they came off. And that's far too many. One thing we would like to do as houndsmen, I heard you guys talking about your problems with the bears in the campground. Our hound club has gotten together, and we'd like to recommend you guys in different areas, guys that will come in to these campgrounds and get it done, and get these bears out. It won't cost anything. There'll be several guys that'll be on call 24/7. If you get a bear in a campground, we'll come in, we'll run it out. It solved the problem. We've been doing it on the scout camp down there above Mount Pleasant. And we haven't had them come back. It's worked really, really well. I give you some names of the scout leaders that's
that are over those camps, and the houndsmen would love to volunteer to be in charge of that. We want to help, but we do want to have something left to chase. And we won't send you, there are a lot of houndsmen out there that do not get it done for you. They can't catch a bear, but there's a lot of them that can, and we'll recommend the best ones for you. But we do need your help with these cats so bad.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate your being here and your comments.
Thank you.
Robert Olson.
I just want to back what Jason's saying. I live down there in Fairview. Our lion population's in trouble. I don't know if there's an emergency closure that can be done. Something needs to be done. I don't understand how it got away from us. I don't understand the logic of filling tags from Alpine in my backyard. Them lions ain't traveling that far. That's bad management. But we need help. Our lions are hurting. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. Tamara?
My name is Tamara.
Tamara.
It's okay. I agree with Bob and Jason. I, too, live in Fairview in the Southwest Manti units, and you know, we love to chase our cats down there, and it's not that when it comes to predators, I can see that nobody really cares when it comes right down to it. And before I moved here, I didn't either. I'm from California, not something I really want to say here, but you know, I love to hunt. I love to hunt deer. I love chasing, you know, cats with my hounds, but they're in trouble. Last year, we chased three cats. Three. That's a mama and two babies. And we had a tom that kind of came in and out. And by the time it was done, mama and two babies. By the time it was done, they were gone. I mean, I remember looking at the quotas, looking at 60-pound cats that were turned in that still had spots. And they were tagged as a female? Or, no, as a tom. You know, I don't know about you, but I think there's a problem there, and we really need help. So we're asking for your help. And I know you can't do anything for a year, but recommendations from a lot of people, especially RAC members, go pretty deep. And that's what we're asking for. That's what I'm asking for.
Thank you, Tamara. Jason Adamson.
That was me.
Oh, did you fill out two cards?
Might be Jason Walker. I'm sorry, I put it at the top of the list. It's for you. You get together.
I'll be glad to.
Jason Adamson.
That's me.
Oh,
maybe
Jason Walker. There we go.
You
got me straight.
First of all, I'd just like to say that I really appreciate the Division of Wildlife for allowing me I really like the freedom to go and pursue cougars on any unit, pretty much. And the pursuit season is very liberal. I just want to state that I really appreciate that. There's a lot of states that don't experience that, that don't have that privilege. So first of all, I'd just like to really say that I appreciate that. Just to get in my spiel, I started to hunt with my father, pursuing cougars in the late 80s, and have continued to pursue cougars up till currently. Call me dumb, crazy, I don't know, but I really enjoy it. And I do probably 90% of my hunting off horseback or hiking, so I'm usually in the backcountry pursuing these cougars. And over the years, I've seen a steady decline from the late 80s. We had quite a few lions back in the late 80s and the mid 90s, and then I've just watched them decline ever since. And now we're giving out twice the amount of lion tags that we used to. And like Jason, I love to hunt deer probably just as much as anybody. And I haven't seen them come back. You know, that seems like that everybody's, but the reason why everybody's pushing for more cougars, but I haven't seen an increase in the deer herd from it personally. So I'd just like to support Dan, and I don't want to, I'm against any increase in lion permits. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jason. Chet Young.
Mr. Chairman and Rack, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us tonight. 3 years ago at the Wildlife Board meeting, when the Manti units were all, four of the units were switched over to a split unit, Justin Shannon was the biologist at the time, and he recommended to the board not to do it because they'd already done a study on them four units and had proved that the coyotes were the problem, not the lions. Right after he made that statement, Director Kaperowitz made the statement of, we need to do the right thing for the deer, but let's make sure we're doing the right thing. You guys can go to the board minutes and it's all right there. So now these units are combined with the Wasatch units, which are sheep units, and the Nebo unit also. I added the numbers together for the Nebo West Face, the Cascade, and the Tim. There's 48 tags allowed. There could be 48 lions killed on them units. The three-year average is 17.32 cats are getting killed off of them three units on a three-year average. So if we're seeing the numbers at 48 when realistically, they should be down around 17, 18 tags. That's the amount of cats that are available. That's what has been getting harvested. That leaves 30.68 tags to get filled off of these Manti units, and it's devastating them. The one unit, the quota was 8. They killed 18 lions off of it. The fear is, if we wait for 3 years for this to come back to discussion, them units will be no better than the temp unit, which is a sheep unit. They're killing two lions a year off of it. The average for 3 years on that unit is 3.66 lions. But yet the quota is at 12, and that's transferring down to the other units. So I'm here asking, and I appreciate you listening. I know what you've said, but I would just like a mention of discussion on this to maybe get the tag numbers set at a realistic number. This is a three-year trial basis, but we need to make, if we're using it for a trial on a standard, something that we're going to be able to roll with 3 years consecutive, year after year after year for 12 years. We need to start out with the right numbers. We've already got the information from the last 3 years that our numbers are up here, but yet the cat population's not. You know, and I just base it on the biologist when them was changed to a split, going against it, saying he already had the proof, and Director Kaperowitz recommending, you know, saying let's do the right thing, but let's make sure it's the right thing. Let's not have a knee-jerk reaction. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chet. Dan Cockane.
Thank you. My name's Dan Cockane, and I'm the line coordinator for the Utah Houndsman Association. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to address you. And I just want to say I appreciate John. We're glad to have him looking after these critters. He cares about them, and he's been a big help to us. I emailed everyone on the list a copy of my stuff, and I apologize if you didn't get it. I can't run that thing very well, but if you don't, I brought a copy. I just want to say that lions are kind of unique. You know, I've been in the woods all my life. I've never seen one except with my hounds. We can't count them. It's just really hard to tell how many there are, but there are some things that we can tell, and And one, I know that you've talked about this, and that we're glad this book is finally published. And one of the things it talks about in that Managing Cougars in North America is one of the signs of a declining cougar population is an increase in the harvest of adult females, and we're seeing that drastically. I've traveled all over the state in the last 4 months talking to houndsmen in little communities, two and three at a time, some 30, 40 in a room. And what I've heard all over the state is that they've never seen the lion population so low. And that really concerns us. There's the target is 17 to 20% females. It's the trigger to adjust the tags is 17 to 20% females. And the last, in 2011, we killed 39% females. In 2012, all the numbers aren't in, it looks like we're somewhere around 34%. And San Pete County is over 40. So we're really concerned about that. What we've targeted in our meetings with the houndsmen is education. We need to stop killing the females. We can kill a tom lion, and another tom will move into the area and take care of breeding and those kind of things. We kill a female, if she averages 12 surviving kittens in her lifetime, and the average is 6, and these are, you know, these are biologist numbers, but if the average is 6 females, by 3 generations, taking that one female out of the population has removed over 2,000 lions out of the population. Taking a female is hurting the lion population. The other thing that happens with females, they're currently doing a study in Montrose, Colorado. They had 3 adult female lions that were collared, that were killed. It was legal to kill a collared female there. It orphaned 8 kittens that had to be euthanized to get the collars back because they're too young to survive on their own. We realize it's a 3-year plan. We're asking for an emergency action, especially in San Pete County. It can be done for the sheep. It can be done for the deer. We can raise the numbers. We can't hit the quotas. We need to lower the female quotas. But there are things that can be done. The guidebook has to be adjusted this year, just as always is, to get the dates lined up. We feel like there's things that can be done that don't change the plan, but that can help with preserving the females. One is the DWR on their website has an excellent cougar orientation, so that to help educate. It's really hard to identify a female from a male, a cougar. And so you take an inexperienced guy who goes and buys a dog, you know, $2,000, you can catch a lion. But to have the experience to know what you're taking is really tough. And that's a volunteer course. Almost every other species, an orientation course is required if you have a tag. We're asking that course becomes mandatory for everyone who has a tag, anyone guiding a hunter, whether it's a paid guide or just a volunteer, and for outfitters. It wouldn't have to change anything with the program. One of the other things that we're asking is that we move the split up to April 1st. The date now is about the 5th of March. March is really a good time to hunt the lions because we consistently get storms, and by moving that up, we think that will help save some females because the guy with the limited entry tag doesn't have to rush out at the end of February and take a female lion to fill his tag. It's created such a competition that we're rushing out and we're killing females. The other trigger to adjust tags is a pursuit survey, how many lions treed per day. Right now we do a random survey, which is about 25% of the hunters, and it's voluntary. We'd like to see that. If you have a pursuit tag, you have to fill out the survey. I was chosen this year. It took me 5 minutes on the computer. It provides a lot of good information for the biologists. It provides a lot of good information for everyone. We just feel like that should be a mandatory thing. The cats that are wearing the collars down on the Monroe are free game. You heard Jason say, we're spending our money, your money, my money, the taxpayers' money to study these cats. We're putting a collar around their neck and then we're shooting them. It just doesn't make any sense to me personally to kill them. If we want to study a dead cat, we're killing 400 a year. We got a pile of them we could study. We feel like we should preserve those collared animals. And then lastly, we would like to see every kill reported with a GPS location. I know down in down around Moab, they just finished a case down there, and they were actually, I think, killing lions in Colorado and tagging them with Utah tags. But because we can be, we can hold, a hunter can hold a harvest objective tag, but he can pursue anywhere in the state. There are a lot of cats that are being killed on a limited entry unit and being reported as killed on a harvest objective unit. And we think that GPS information would be valuable to the biologists and for law enforcement. So that's what we're about. We're putting all of our efforts as a club into educating hunters, especially the young guys that are coming up. It kind of was an atmosphere of they're our competition, and what we're trying to convince the houndsmen is these hunters are our future. We need to take them under our wing and help educate them. We need your help with that. We feel like it's time for an emergency adjustment on some numbers on the Sanpete units. So thank you.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you to all of the rest of you who, again, made the time and effort to come here tonight and let us know how you're feeling about that. There are a couple of things I would note with regard to who might be listening to you. We do have a board member here tonight, and I'm sure that John has been listening and he is aware of your concerns. In addition to that, the minutes of this meeting are sent to all of the board members, and I know by experience that all of our board members on the Wildlife Board read all of the minutes that are sent to them. So in terms of you being here tonight, I think it's worthwhile for you to be here and express your concerns. And while it is not an action item, and we will not be taking any action on what you've told us tonight, you can be assured that the Wildlife Board will read our minutes, and they'll know that you were here and have expressed your concerns. And in addition to that, I think that John will take back to the Wildlife Board what you have said tonight. So again, we appreciate you being here. We have heard your concerns with regard to cougars, and that concern will be relayed to the Wildlife Board. That is the body that will need to take action if any action is taken before a year from now when the plan is up. So we'll go to our last item. We'll ask John to come up again, and John is going to give us a update presentation on what's been going on with the coyote predator program that the state has been involved with. John?
Thank you. I've put together this as a informational just presentation. The program, as Predator and Control Incentive Program, is new. We're rolling it out right away, and it's been happening really quite rapidly, actually. So there's been a lot going on rather quickly, and we're doing our best to keep up with it. But there have been a lot of questions about it from all the regions, and every one of the regions have wanted me to throw something in and just discuss it a little bit. So I put this together. Little background, little history. In terms of predator management, Utah relative to the four neighboring states, we're already, five neighboring states. We're already, in terms of predator control, the amount we spend on it. We spend as much in Utah in the last years as the other states do combined for the most part. What's going to change now, this year, that guy is going to pop up to 1.1 million, and it's going to be off the graph in terms of what we've been doing historically. So we've been historically high, and we're going to really bump that up even more. Why is this? Two reasons. One, the first bill is Senator Hankins sponsored predator control funding. This one has the $5 fee on big game hunting licenses to fund the removal of predatory animals. This is the one that added the fee to the license. And the second one is the Mule Deer Protection Act by Senator Okerlund. And this is the one that requires the DWR to reduce coyote populations for the benefit of mule deer. It's very very explicit in the language of what we're doing and why. And it tells us that we need to authorize and we need to work with specific members of the public. It authorizes the division to contract with members of the public to reduce coyote populations for the benefit of mule deer. Okay, so what's happening with the funding? Predator control funding, most of that's going to go to Wildlife Services, about $600,000 for targeted control. So Wildlife Services will continue what they've been doing, the helicopter type work and in the remote areas. The Mule Deer Protection Act funds, and that's the one that we're rolling into pure public contracts, and that's going to be $500,000 this year. And the way the law outlines how we work with people, how we set up contractors, we have two options. One is this general predator control program, and the other is the targeted predator control program. The general predator control program is the one that most people are familiar with, that the press has been talking about mostly, and this is the one where we contract with people from the general public to remove coyotes wherever, and this is happening right now. Then the targeted one, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later in the presentation, is where we can use specific vendors, where we hire specific individuals as contractors to remove coyotes from certain places to target specific sites. The biology of it, so what the division's done is try to recommend specific locations for removals, targeting places where it can work, where there actually are deer, where deer have fawning grounds, places where coyotes can be removing fawns and actually impacting the population. And we're also recommending that people time the removals at the time of year when it can do the most good, essentially. That is, we want to target, so it's the most efficient of removals after coyote social groups are stable and before pups are produced. So that is that December, January, February, and into the fawning time frame. The idea there is that if you're hunting coyotes in the fall, that's when they're dispersing, that's when they're moving around, that's when they're likely to be die from other circumstances. And also, they're not going to be the same coyotes that are shooting there aren't going to be the ones that are there killing deer in the spring. So it's best to wait. And also do it again before pups are produced, that December, January time period, so only two coyotes are removed instead of a family of eight. So that makes it more efficient. The recommended locations at this point is still just a very basic map that we've put together for folks if they sign up to the program that just highlights where our deer herds are for the most part. And it's not very precise, but it gives people at least a start on that. To participate in the program, it's fairly simple, but people do have to register first. They have to go online, log in, create a customer ID, and then take an informal test, more or less, 10 questions. That what it really does is just outlines the requirements of the program and gives people information about why they're doing it, where they're doing it, and why we're making recommendations the way we are. So it's not to make it difficult, it's to educate people. And this is another part of the law, is to provide some education. They have to produce some information, their social security number, their address, because they will get a check later and there are tax implications of this. So we do need some basic information. This isn't just somebody handing out $50 bills during the day. To request their compensation, they'll have to come in with the lower jaw plus either the scalp with ears or the whole pelt. We're recommending people take coyotes at the time of year when it's most beneficial, which in winter, which coincides when those pelts are the best. So I'm encouraging people to skin out winter good condition pelts, whole pelts. We'll notch the ears, pull a tooth from the jaw and a tissue sample, and then they can still sell the pelt. So they could receive compensation plus some money for the pelt if they do it at the right time of year. The tissue sample has to do with genetics, and I do want to be able to identify coyotes to region. We're putting together a database, or we'll put together a database where we can genetically describe coyotes. And certainly the plan is to be able to tell a Utah coyote from a Nebraska coyote or a Kansas coyote or something, in order to try to keep the honest people honest a little bit. We are requiring a GPS location, and that can mean that we would like a GPS location, but we understand a lot of people aren't good with GPS and electronics, and we will take a map. And if they have it, we need a good location. We need to know where these coyotes are being removed from. We need to know where the coyotes are being hit hard, where they're not being hit at all, and that'll come into play a little bit later. So that, and then we need to assess if this program's working. So locations are going to be important, but we will work with people in order to get the locations as good as we can. They can only request compensation at posted places. It won't be just a free-for-all at any division office at any time of day. We're getting all that stuff up and running. It's going to be online here real soon, the next couple weeks, and then people will know. But there will be various locations throughout the state where they can turn in their coyote. They do everything correctly. If they've registered, they show up, they have the right materials, they'll receive $50 for their coyote. So again, we're recommending that people wait till December, but they can go ahead and remove coyotes now if they'd like to, but they'll need to hold the scalps and jaws until we're ready. The locations and times will be updated on the web, so we're running a lot of this just online. People log in, find out where they can turn in their coyotes, and then they'll be able to do it. So I have had some questions about, with this starting in July, why is it taking so much time to turn in coyotes? Couple reasons. One, it's a brand new statewide program. It's huge. No other state's done anything like this, so we're treading new ground. We've got to track $500,000 to thousands of different people potentially. As of this point, about 3,000 people have signed up to the program, and if each of those shows up with multiple coyotes, we need to stay on top of it. We need to follow state purchasing rules and make sure everything's done above board and tracked correctly. We are also trying to set up, as I said, a variety of locations people can turn their coyotes in. We're trying to make it so no one has to travel more than an hour to get to a location. But balancing that with not hiring a bunch of new people has been a challenge for us. So that's been a logistical hurdle, but we're going to overcome it. It's just taking some time. The other half of the program is the Targeted Predator Control Program. I hinted at that earlier. This is going to start in the fall of 2013, probably, and this will be with approved vendors. So we're encouraging people that are interested in being contractors with the state to remove coyotes to sign up this year, show that they're efficient, that they can remove coyotes, and if they get 20, 25 or so, collect good records, then they can be into an approved vendors list that we can draw upon to actually make private contracts with people. One of the other reasons that those GPS locations are so important, because that's what's going to feed into this program. If we know that we've got places in the state where we're really hitting coyotes hard, and then we're expecting to see donut holes in places where fawn-doe ratios might still be a problem, but people aren't getting to, that's when we can draw on this targeted control program to hire people specifically to hit those donut holes to remove coyotes in those areas. And the only way we can get that is by getting those locations. Finally, will this program work? Relative to predator removal for the protection of mule deer and other species, the simple answer is it's sometimes yes, sometimes no. One of the things to remember, it's important to remember that coyotes are not the only factor impacting mule deer. Other things such as weather and habitat are extremely, if not more, important. You can remove all the coyotes there are, one in a place in any given year, and if you have a bad winter, it doesn't matter. It's not going to help those deer. So the other thing is questions about how this is going to impact coyote populations. Locally, it might impact coyote populations, but the multiple years of studies on these guys has indicated that if you want to remove coyotes from an area and really impact the population, you need to remove about 70% of them for multiple years in a row in order to knock that population down. They've got incredible reproductive potential, and what you won't see out of this program is no coyotes in Utah anymore. Coyotes will still be in Utah even after this. We hope that coyote populations will be reduced and fawn survival will be increased. We're doing our best to implement this program as best we can, but right at this point, it's a wait and see. And that's why we're collecting the location, age data on coyotes, population data, and we'll be able to use that to evaluate the program in the next coming year, see, okay, is this a program working? Is this a good use of funds? And be able to evaluate it. So that's my quick rundown on the predator program. And I'd be happy to, if you have questions about it.
Thank you again, John, for that update. Do you have any questions, John?
Where are the locations published where people can go to turn in their coyotes?
And that's going to be online. We're putting that in that Utah Predators. It's at that site. It's not on right now, so we're encouraging people to, they're going to need to log in over the next couple weeks. I'm working closely with all the regions. John and I were just talking about it a bunch today, too. We're trying to make sure we've got people. What you're probably going to see is in some regions you'll have three different sites, and then one site will be every Monday from 5 to 8, and another, a different place, Richfield, Tuesday, 5 to 8. So they'll rotate around, and we're putting that together. We'll publish it. I'm envisioning what the September schedule is going to be. We'll see how many people show up, if we get swamped, if we need more resources in one place or another, and then we'll adjust that schedule. So we're putting it online. You're going to start to see it in the next couple weeks.
Other questions? Again, thank you for a great presentation, and we appreciate your efforts. That ends our agenda for this evening. Again, audience members, thank you for being here. We always appreciate your attendance and your willingness to show up and let us know how you feel. RAC members, thank you for coming out on a hot summer evening. The board meeting that will consider our actions tonight will be on Thursday, August 16th, and the next RAC meeting is a month from now on Tuesday, September 11th. Until then, drive safely and have a good summer.